My name's Howard Taylor. I write an illustrated comic strip called Schlock Mercenary. You may have walked past some books that look something like this, only with fewer naked people on the cover. This is the advanced copy of the most recent book. They're not naked, they're wearing cave thongs. And I assure you that this book, when it comes out, is full of all kinds of obscuring shrubbery. I write an illustrated comic strip, science fiction comic, and I've been doing it now for about 12 years. Been nominated for a few awards, won a couple of them. I've been drawing for just a hair longer than I've actually been publishing the comic strip. That first picture was drawn at age 31, and I promise you, nobody looks at that picture and says, dude, quit your day job now. Nobody does. Second picture was drawn, it's a version of Sergeant Schlock that was drawn for a convention called Lunacon. Picture took, the ink, the pencil and ink work there took maybe 20 minutes. And then pulling it into Photoshop, actually I colored it with markers, and then pulled it into Photoshop to add some more, you know, logo type shininess. And move this thing further out of my way because I don't want to stand in front of the screen. Maybe another 20 minutes. So 40 minutes worth of work, and I turn out what ended up on t-shirts and badges for a convention where I was the artist guest of honor. What is the difference between those two pictures? About 12 years. If you looked at the syllabus, there are a couple of URLs. The top one is free. You can go read it. And I would encourage you, if you get nothing else out of the show, read that top URL, link to it from the syllabus. Go read that article, because reading that article and internalizing that information has more power to change the world than anything else I really tell you. But now I'm going to tell you about some of the things that are in that article. And that article is based off of a scientific journal piece here, which if you're really into the science, you can go subscribe and, you know, pay money and have access to it. Now I'm going to tell you about the study. 400 randomly selected 10-year-olds in the New York public school system. Randomly selected from various classes. Basically, a researcher would get permission to work with a child in that class, and then the experiment began. The first thing they did, they were all given IQ tests, and then they were randomly divided into two groups, and this is a double-blind sort of study, so the person doing the dividing into the groups isn't the person then subsequently monitoring how the two groups perform. Divide into two groups. The first group was told, regardless of the results of the test, the first group was told, you must be really smart. The second group was told, you must have worked really hard on this. That is the only difference in how these children were treated. Okay? And that's regardless, again, of the results of the test. There were kids who totally bombed the IQ test who were told, you must be really smart. And there were kids who put no effort whatsoever into the test and were told, you must have worked hard on this. Those were not indicators. They then offered these children a second test. And they had a couple of choices. They could take a harder test, which was described as being more challenging. Are we working on the air conditioning here?
Okay. I got called to change the temperature. I'm assuming
warm it up. Oh, no, that's fine.
You warm it up or down?
Okay. How many people are cold? Everybody's cold.
Temperature's up.
You didn't ask how many people are cold.
You know what? I saw enough hands go up that I went ahead and declared a simple majority. Okay. How many of you are too hot?
Just right.
I didn't put on enough cologne. Horrible day. Very sorry. Okay. So they were offered the choice between a test that was described as being more challenging or a test that was described as being similar or they didn't really say easy, but a test that's similar to this one. Do you want to take another test just like this one? Do you want to take a harder test? The majority of the kids who were told, you must be smart, picked the easy test. 90% of the children who were told, you must have worked hard on this, asked for a harder test. At this point in my life, as I was reading this article, a portion of me started to die. And it was the portion of me that had been telling my children they were smart, because I believed that they were smart, because I believed that my parents were smart, and I was smart, and I'd married a woman who was far more intelligent than I, except for the fact that I managed to trick her into marrying me, and so our children must therefore be smart, and I've been telling them this, and I had this closely held belief that we all have talents and abilities, and suddenly that part of me is dying. They then administered a third test. This test, the kids didn't get a choice. This test was two grade levels higher than the test that the kids had been administered before. The you must be smart kids languished, they acted depressed, they assumed they weren't smart after all, and they gave up. The you must have worked hard kids focused, they got interested, and some of them remarked, this was my favorite test. Then they administered a fourth test. This fourth test was basically the same as the very first test. The you must be smart kids performed 20% worse than they did on the first test. Having failed at the third test, they had suddenly, this is me telling stories about how this must have shaken out. They suddenly stopped believing that they were smart, and their performance dropped. The you must have worked hard kids performed 30% better than they did the first time. Okay, my daughter was in a gifted program at the time that we were reading this information. My daughter was in a gifted program, and after I read this article, my wife and I looked at her schoolwork and we realized we've been doing this exactly wrong. We've been telling her for years that she's smart. We've been telling her that she has a responsibility to use her talents well. We've been reinforcing this idea that she's smart, and we need to stop doing that. Now, that doesn't mean we need to start telling her she's dumb. That means we need to start telling her, you worked hard on this. We need to reward the hard work. So this is a picture she drew at age 14. This is also a picture she drew at age 14. I'm a professional artist, okay? My daughter started bringing me her artwork, and I stopped saying, wow, you're really good at this. And I started saying, it's not bad. Does that look like a hand to you? What don't you like about this picture? Why does a 14-year-old child bring a picture to her father? Does she bring it for an art critique, or does she bring it for validation because she believes that it's not good enough, but she wants somebody else to tell her it is? And so I'd ask her, well, what don't you like about it? And then let's find ways to fix it. And this was kind of painful for her sometimes. She complained. Matter of fact, when I give this presentation and she happens to be around, she scowls at me because she knows I've said, does that really look like a hand to you? Are those knees? Those don't look like knees to me. But she has learned, and she has gotten better and better and better at art, and she's gotten better and better very, very quickly because I've been rewarding the work that she does. She was in a German class and was failing German. And my wife and I sat down and we talked about this. He said, how do we solve this problem? How do we solve this parenting problem with this child who is failing a language class in junior high? And what we decided, based on the information we had, we decided we are not going to reward results. We're going to reward actual effort. And so we told her, look, regardless of what grade you get, if you spend 15 minutes a day working on your German, where we can see you working on German, then if you fail the class, you don't have to take the class again, that's fine. You're done with German, that's okay. And if you pass the class, well, congratulations, your study paid off. If you decide not to put in the time, if you decide to do other stuff and you fail the class, then you're retaking it. And if you pass the class, well, you got lucky and you didn't learn anything from this exercise and we're bad parents. She decided to put in the time and she ended up pulling off a B in the class. And then she decided to take the next year of German because she loved German and realized that she didn't really know as much about it as she wanted to. And the work had paid off. And suddenly we have a kid who used to be a you must be smart kid who has now become a you must have worked hard on this kid, deciding to take on something that is challenging and becoming better at what they're doing because the work is being rewarded. I've got to tell you, as somebody who was raised going to gifted schools and being told I was smart, and looking at my work in college, looking at some of my work, I'm gesturing over at Scott. I worked at Novell with Scott for years. Looking at some of the things that I did at Novell, it took me 3/4 of my life to realize that it doesn't matter how gifted I may or may not be, I have to believe that it's work that matters. I have to convince myself that my talent is irrelevant. And not only that, I need to go back and I need to save my children from the damage that my parents did to me. This was a significant moment for us. If you get two things out of this class, the first one is go read that article. The second one is these 5 words. You worked hard on this. Those words, I don't care who you say them to, but say them. Say them a lot. And if you look at a child's work and you can tell that they didn't work hard, call them on it. Wow. How much time did you spend on this? No, really. I mean, this looks like the hard work you've done in the past, but this looks a little slipshod here. Maybe we need to sit down and talk German or algebra or whatever. Those 5 words. You worked hard on this. Please. Now, let's talk about this chart. A lot have been made out of this chart in the last 20 years since it aired. The age group cutoff for youth soccer is August. This graph is showing you the birth month distribution of kids at age 19 who are in the World Cup youth soccer tournament. So at age 19, almost 50% of the children, under 20s and under 17s is the other distribution there. Almost 50% of those kids were born in August through October. Well, what advantage can an August birthday possibly confer upon you in an environment where the age cutoff is the 1st of August?
You missed the deadline. You're a whole year older.
You're a whole year older. Well, but at age 19, how much of an advantage is that really? A 19-year-old versus an 18-year-old? Really?
A lot.
That's a compound advantage.
Jack, it is no different at all. Here's the difference. At age 9, the coach looks at his kids and says, I want you big kids over here working on being forwards because you're intimidating, and you smaller kids I'm going to work in other ways. And the coaches end up spending more of their time with the bigger kids between the ages of 9 and 12. And then, you know, by the time, most of these are probably boys, by the time the boys hit, you know, 13 and 14, they're hitting their growth spurts, and that growth is now it's statistical noise. And so there's no difference, except the August birthdays, the September birthdays, the October birthdays have a bunch of extra time with the coach. And now the coaches are saying, yeah, I've already got some star players here. Sure, half of them were born in, you know, born before October. What's that got to do with anything? Hey, maybe they were just bigger. A lot gets made out of this, and what we found in studies, when this study came out, they looked at this information, they said, this is statistically very significant. It's got to mean something. What does it mean? And so they drilled down and started looking at what it meant. Here's another interesting factoid. There is a single element that will make a young man 400 times more likely to to play baseball as a professional than any other element. Was Dad a professional baseball player? 400 times. Now that makes perfect sense, because obviously if Dad was a professional baseball player, his genetics are cued for professional baseball, and that's passed down to... No. That's not how it works. When Dad says, hey, let's go throw some catch, he's a pro baller, and he's correcting his son's form with every throw and with every catch, so that by the time the kid hits 11 in Little League, he's already one of the star players, regardless of his birthday. So, let's start applying this to us a little bit. Henry Miller said you've got to write a million words before you write your first true word. David Gerrold said your first million words are for practice. They don't count. And then he said if you get paid for some of your first million words, go ahead and start practicing cashing the checks. I love David Gerrold. In chess, it's statistically rare to attain international master status in less than 10 years of intense chess training. In music composition, and this is information that's been gathered statistically, this isn't me talking out of my ear, in fact I'll give you the URL for most of this. In music composition, 10 years experience appears to be the minimum before the first outstanding pieces are composed. For scientists, authors, and poets, the average time between first publication and publication of their greatest work, just over 10 years. What is it about 10 years? Top link is to the graph and talks about the International Review. It's the paper that's got the graph. Second, the role of deliberate practice in the acquisition of expert performance. Erickson, Cramp, and Teschromer, Psychological Review, from 1993. It's almost 20 years old. And you can read this PDF. It's like a 90-page PDF on their research. If you love science, dig into the PDF and look at what they were doing, because these guys were trying to figure out, the answer to talent, the answer to expert performance. And finally, How to Be Creative by Jonah Lehrer. This is free, wallstreetjournal.com with a URL. The long URL was like a big string of numbers. There's no way I could try and post that. Hopefully you can write that down and remember it. Adapted from his book, Imagine How Creativity Works, which is a fascinating book in and of itself, and I can't even scratch the surface of what's in there. Well, I can scratch the surface, which is what I'm going to do. Now, this quote from Erickson, the search... They're all in the PDF. It's all in the PDF, but if you wanted to write it down, fantastic. You'll remember it better if you try to write it down. The search for stable, heritable characteristics that could predict or at least account for the superior performance of eminent individuals has been surprisingly unsuccessful. All right, who wants to venture an English translation of what we just read in that is actual English? Yes, ma'am.
Genes don't make the man.
All right, well, close. I mean, let's, from the actual scientific, what has he said? He said, we can't prove that we inherit things. We've looked for it. We have hunted for talent, and we cannot find it. From a scientific standpoint, the key phrase is, or the key word is, predict. Science wants to be able to predict. We can't. We've tried and tried and tried, and we can't predict who is going to be a great baseball player, who is going to be a great musician, who is going to be a great writer. We can't predict it. We just don't know. And when we're looking for stable, heritable characteristics, we can't find this. Then they went on to say, you thought that one was a mouthful. Here we go. Let's see how my reading is. The belief that the striking differences between expert performers and less accomplished performers reflect innate abilities, talent, is so strong that the failure to identify the specific talents necessary for expert performance in a given domain is viewed, at most, as a temporary problem until the relevant talents are discovered. The conviction in the importance of talent appears to be based on the insufficiencies of alternative hypotheses to explain the exceptional nature of expert performance. Wow. Okay, I'm out of breath. What he said is, we continue to believe in talent, even though science can't find it, because we don't have any good alternative explanations for where really good performance comes from. This was the foundation of Erickson's research. Erickson wanted to know where expert performance came from. And what he arrived at was the idea that the idea that it has something to do with the way in which we practice. This graph probably describes your career and probably describes many of the things that you do. When you were first introduced to whatever the domain was, let's say cooking, you threw things on the stove with wild abandon and discovered that cooking was fun, but you could still barely make grilled cheese. Neat ocular effect. Okay, now we're done being distracted by my shadow. Then suddenly you get a little bit of training with cooking. Maybe you went to a cooking school and decided to become a chef. And you quickly get better, and then you kind of plateau. All right? And then you are, let's say, you know, married, and everybody in the household is now depending on what it is that you cook, and you get better again, and then you plateau, and you've been making biscuits for the same way for the last 15 years. It ain't just biscuits. It's music composition, it's writing, it's basketball, it's baseball. When we are first introduced to a domain, we improve until we start taking, we start initiating practice. And then we get better, we start to plateau, and then we transition to a full-time involvement. And then we get better a little bit, and then we plateau again. Why did we not just keep getting better and better and better forever? Because we had a plateau here, and we broke through. What changed this? I'm not asking a rhetorical question. I'm actually going to provide the answer. That stage three plateau is the result of money. How many of you have ever taken a shortcut in your work? You looked at your work and said, you know what? There's an easy way to do this and a hard way to do this. And the hard way is better, but the easy way, key phrase, still gets me paid. Any of you ever done this? Scott, has it ever happened? Oh, yeah. Happens all the time. I do it in my writing. I do it in my illustrating. I take that shortcut all the time. You know, back in 2007, 2008, when I first looked at this material, it was... I felt much better about using Tiger Woods as an example of anything. He had plateaued as a golfer and decided to take a summer off where he was not, maybe it wasn't a summer, but he decided to take a season off where he was not golfing for money because he needed to reinvent his game. He wanted to go back and hit balls for practice instead of hitting balls for money. And the result was... he jumped from here on the curve to here on the curve, and his game got better, and he really became a force of nature in golf, and then it went to his head, and other things happened. When I was drawing the comic strip, for the first 6 years, I was really struggling to get by. I wasn't trying to do it full-time until 2004. Between 2004 and 2006, I was trying to do it full-time, and I was here, you know, I saw this little bump. And then we published the first Schlock Mercenary book, and suddenly we could pay the bills, and it was fantastic, and we put out another book, and it appeared to have momentum, and 6 books later, here I am working at this full time, and my art has not improved dramatically for about 5 or 6 years. I looked at one of the things that I don't do well. I don't draw hands well, and I thought, you know, I'm going to practice drawing hands. I'm going to draw a bunch of hands that I'm not getting paid for. So I drew a bunch of hands, and very shortly thereafter, Tracy Hickman invited me to illustrate Extreme Dungeon Mastery for him, which has a bunch of technical illustrations of magic tricks in it, which required me to draw hands holding cards in such a way that you could sit down and duplicate the trick with your own hands. I mean, that's way beyond a cartoonist saying, oh, does that really look like a hand to you? No, this is, does that look like a proper S-fold? Does that, you know, is this how you juggle that little silver ball back and forth? Curtis's or Tracy's son Curtis, professional magician, looked at my illustrations when it was all done and said, look, I know we just put these in a goofy little game book, but those are now the best illustrations of these magic tricks anywhere in the world. Because everybody else who makes these illustrations just takes grainy black and white photos of the magician's hand and expects you to figure it out from there. Did I get paid a whole bunch of money for this? No. Did practice pay off? Absolutely. Have I learned my lesson and gone on to drawing things like feet and knees and dynamic poses? No, because I'm making money. How does this apply to you as creative professionals? Well, the first thing that applies, I skipped this slide a little early, but you can go ahead and look at the yin-yang symbol and have a Zen moment. The first thing is look for what is most difficult for you to do currently. As writers, somebody volunteer some information. What's hardest for you as a writer? Yes, ma'am?
Plotting. I know, it's terrible. I shouldn't have said
that out loud. Oh, no. Plot's hard. What else?
Pacing.
Oh, yeah. Pacing's difficult. Character is difficult. Dialogue is difficult.
Word count.
Okay. Word count is difficult. I know how to fix word count. Copy and paste. No. keep writing. And one of the things, and I think Kevin J. Anderson talked about this he talked about productivity, butt in chair, hands on keyboard. Make yourself write. Practice. You will reach a moment during the day where you think, oh, you know what? I've probably written enough for the day. That right there. That is your opportunity to say, oh, I'm about to take a shortcut and go have a sandwich. Let's do this the hard way and write for another hour. That's how you pad your word count. Pad is not the right word, but that's how you learn. You practice it. Look for the hard stuff and say, hey, you know what? I really don't like plotting. So I'm going to sit down this week and I'm going to write once per day. I am going to write a tightly plotted outline for 6 different genres. I'm going to do a mystery, I'm going to do a thriller, I'm going to do a slasher, I'm going to do an alien invasion science fiction story, and I'm going to do a YA paranormal romance, and I'm going to outline each of them, and at the end of that week, you'll probably have maybe one outline that you're willing to use, and 5 outlines that have made your plotting better. These are things you can practice. The other thing that you need, and that Erickson points out, is access to an expert. How many of you are in writing groups? Okay, how many of you have people in your writing group who are willing to look at what you've done and say, wow, does that really look like a hand to you? Okay, yeah, that's helpful. What's even more helpful is for somebody to say, you know, you're not doing deep penetration very well. You should read this book, and then you should do some writing exercises on deep penetration. A couple of these scenes and, you know, rewrite them from a different POV and practice that, because I think that's what this book needs. That sort of an expert, well, that's why we go to writing camps, is to have access to these sorts of people. I promise you, if you get access to somebody like that and they look at your writing and say, wow, you need to work on this, try the following writing exercises and, you know, write 10,000 words of tagless dialogue to develop character voices so that we can tell who your characters are without, you know, Jenny said, Bob said, Amy said, Bill exclaimed. That sort of thing. Now, creativity. The Jonah Lehrer book, Imagine, some high points from that. First of all, let me ask you a question. Creativity, is it a talent? Is it a gift?
A little bit.
Prove it.
Depends on me.
Okay, no, and I mean this in the best possible way. You can look at creative people and you can say, oh, they just got the gift. Please don't. And for whatever you do, please don't tell them they've got a gift. Tell them, wow, that's really creative. You worked hard on this. Because you want them to continue to be creative and reward you with the output of their wonderful brain. Okay? Creativity is something that can be taught. It's something that we can get better at. And in Jonah Lehrer's book, he offers some pointers for creativity. For me, it falls into these three. There are problems which, when our brains are relaxed or tired or sort of loose, there are problems that we kind of just come up with the solutions for. There are also problems which, when we're tired and relaxed and loose, we're never going to solve the problem because the problem requires a brute force, concentrated approach. Thomas Edison and the light bulb. When somebody has a good idea in a comic strip, we draw a light bulb over their head. Matter of fact, drawing the light bulb over the head of a comic strip character is itself a good idea. And we should draw a light bulb over the head of the guy who first drew the, I'm not going to go down, I think that's recursive. Thomas Edison had this idea that, light bulbs would be a lot cheaper to run and to use if they weren't these gas lamp things or these arc lamp things. We probably just need to find the right filament and maybe hold it in a vacuum, I don't know. And so that was the intuitive, relaxed sort of Edison. And then there's the Edison who we probably all read about in school, who said, invention is 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. Relax, there's the 1% inspiration. And then he sat down and tried filament after filament after filament after filament until he finally arrived at tungsten in a vacuum and changed the world forever. Knowing the difference between when to be inspired and when to sweat is probably where some of the people who we think we are, naturally creative, they probably just twigged to this early and realized, hey, you know what? I think I'm just going to take a bath. And they get out of the bathtub and start to write because they've had the idea that they need. Those pieces have shaken. One of the things that I love most about being a full-time creative professional, hey Dan, Dan Wells, not going to come in and interrupt us. One of the things that I love most is that I can actually adhere to this principle. I can say, hey, you know what? I don't know what's supposed to happen next. I've got a pretty good idea of the things that could happen next. I just need to mull this over, and so I'll take a nap. My nap only lasts for about 15 minutes, and then I wake up and realize, oh, that was the piece I needed. And then, can't take another nap. Then I have to sit down and I have to write it. And sometimes I have to rewrite it, and sometimes I have to refine it. And sometimes I get it to where I'm going to sit down and draw on it, and I realize, I wrote that wrong because that doesn't lend itself well to a good picture. Is it time for another nap? I probably need to sketch some pictures. Relax, concentrate, and repeat. There are problems that we can solve well by being a little drowsy. How many of you are morning people? Okay. Have you ever written something really amazing or solved a problem late at night? Some of you? Okay. That may be your inspired time, because late at night, I just want to go to bed. I'm tired. I had this happen on Twitter. Any of you follow me on Twitter? At Howard Taylor on Twitter. Oh, two hands from, you follow me twice? That's kind of creepy. I tweeted, I was sitting in the kitchen, I was getting ready to go to bed, and said, getting ready for bed, realized I need to kill somebody, went downstairs and took care of business. I love being a writer. The tweet itself, kind of funny, but what actually happened was I was sitting in the kitchen thinking, what should happen next? What's glass of water. It's probably time for Binny to break out of quarantine and start murdering people. That might work. Ooh. All right, I'll totally remember that in the morning. Ooh. No, I'm not going to remember that in the morning. And downstairs and wrote. So this process, I don't know how it works for you, but you need to know that it can work. You need to know that if you don't feel creative, you can jumpstart it. Some of these tips included get groggy, daydream away, think like a child. When subjects are told to imagine themselves as 7-year-olds, they score significantly higher on tests of divergent thinking, such as trying to invent alternative uses for an old car tire. When Christ says, except you become as a little child, I look at that and thinking, I wonder if he meant, I don't know. Laugh it up. Find something funny. When we laugh, we relax. It changes the way our brain works. And sometimes we can find solutions in new ways. I want to open up for questions in a couple of minutes. Here are some takeaways. Carol Dweck's research, she's the one who did the research on the New York school kids. Carol Dweck's research suggests that the belief that your efforts to improve will make a difference in your performance, that belief is itself empowering. As evidenced by her research, if you believe that innate abilities are what count, failure is going to be crippling, and you're probably not going to be as successful, and you may actually end up with mental health problems. Whereas, if you believe that your efforts to improve will make a difference in your performance, you are mentally empowering yourself to make those changes. When you share that belief with other people, you are doing them an incredible favor. I really wish that, and maybe it'll take 10 years, that her research could become the core of how we manage our educational institutions. Stop telling children they're special. Yes, yes, children are special and we love them, but stop telling them that and start telling them, you worked hard on this, and change their lives. Failure does not mean the absence of ability. Have any of you ever been told, don't quit your day job? Anybody ever looked at your writing and told you, ooh, don't quit your day job? Okay, you have my permission, the next time that happens, to imagine yourself punching them in the nose. I'm not giving you permission to perform actual violence, but I am empowering you to perform psychic violence on them because they have earned it. They don't, and you don't have the right, the responsibility, or even the ability to look at what someone else has done and determine whether or not they have talent. You don't know that. Kevin J. Anderson was told time and again, wow, your writing's just not very good. He's selling an awful lot of books. And okay, I read one of his early science fiction books that he wrote while he was at LLNL, and I did not like it very much. I wondered how it got published. But he spent a lot of time refining those abilities, and I like his books a lot better now. They're awesome. Does he have talent? I don't know, and it doesn't matter. And it's not my job to say whether he does or doesn't. Find an expert to help you focus your practice. If you are an expert in anything, cooking, basketball, basket weaving, whatever, pay it forward and be the expert for somebody else. Look at somebody else's work and don't think, wow, kid, you just don't have the gift. Think, wow, you're here, hold your hand a little differently right there. Nope, relax your grip on the pencil and there you go. See what happened? Do that for 20 minutes and bring that back to me. Okay, be the expert for somebody else and change the world. And finally, save the future and tell a child you worked hard on this, please. I can't stress that one enough. After what I've seen, both anecdotally and through the research that I keep reading, that has more power than just about anything else I've said. Talking about that, you know, relax, hold the pencil a little differently. This is also a picture from my daughter, who unfortunately was a little bit influenced by some of the political cartoons that I'd been looking at just for research, in that she decided to label things, but none of these things needed labels. She was relaxing and drawing from the relaxed part of her brain, and suddenly there was a fluidity to this art that expressed some of her teenage angst in a way that was incredibly powerful. Peace probably is as powerful for you as it is for me, and it probably is as powerful for me as it is for her, but this was the result of her applying some of this and taking the stress that was in her life and pouring it out in a new way. Now, let's do a Q&A and talk about whatever it is that you want to talk about. If you've got questions, I've got answers, even if they're wrong, and most of them probably are. You flinched. Go.
So what you're saying makes a lot of sense, especially in terms of the dialogue with people and how it impacts them. So how does that play into you think about the fact that we are not all biologically exactly the same? We're not computers, right? So there are differences. How does that play into
Sorry, trying to remember the guy's name. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, in his book The Black Swan, said that if you take all the people, you take 1,000 people from all walks of life and line them up according to height, we will have a variance of maybe, adults, line them up according to height, we'll have a variance of maybe 50%, where the shortest people are 4'9", 4'10". I mean, obviously people come in shorter flavors than that, but our random sampling might not. And the tallest will be, you know, 6'8". Now, let's represent those people with a bar graph, and the bars are representative of how much money they make. And we will see a graph that looks like this. The range of human accomplishment is fantastically greater than the range of natural human ability, what we're born with. We are born with a variability that just looks like noise compared to the variability of what we can accomplish. Does that make sense? I mean, I'm using money as accomplishment, and sometimes money isn't accomplishment, it's just inheritance. But when you look at the skill level that Yo-Yo Ma has with the violin versus the skill level that the average high school violinist has, it's like putting a 30-foot tall man next to a child on that football field in comparison of their ability. So yes, we all have different levels of abilities, but compared to what we can become when we practice, when we focus on developing whatever natural abilities we have, those abilities are irrelevant. They're like a 5-foot head start on a mile-long race. I hope that's helpful. And that metaphor gets used by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Nicholas Taleb uses a lot in his book, The Black Swan. I know it's been used in other places, but I can't remember all of them. There were two hands. Go ahead.
I just had a quick question. This book that you mentioned, I'm not sure, was it Imagine How Creativity Works or something?
Yes.
Like that? Did it have a brief thing about a surfer in it that had Asperger's?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
How about the people that invented the Swiffer?
Might have.
Okay.
you may already have read it. That would be fantastic.
Well, yeah, there's a story.
Okay. Heidi.
I've got the smart kid syndrome. You know, you're so smart. Oh, I failed at something, and now I'm not smart anymore. And it's affected me my whole life. I've refused to write because I'm like, I know I'm going to fail. That means I'm an idiot. And so here I am, just barely starting to write. How do you overcome that programming in your own head? As a writer, you fail every time you try to write. It's not as good as it should be. And immediately the response is, I'm so stupid. How do you overcome that programming in your own brain?
We are infinitely reprogrammable. I don't know what'll work for you. A lot of different things work for me. Lately, I've started telling myself, you might be practicing the wrong thing. When I want to lose some weight. I'm about 30 pounds heavier than I want to be. Okay. And when I am hungry, you know, especially if I've exercised, when I'm hungry, I'll eat. And I try and control my intake a little bit. I was eating the other day, and I had that thought, you know, right now, you may be practicing the wrong thing. Oh, crap. I'm hungry and I'm eating. I mean, it's a natural biological response, but perhaps there's something else that I should be doing. Perhaps when I'm hungry, I should be having a glass of water. And if you look at diet books, hungry people who have a glass of water and then eat often do a lot better. It is possible that, well, possible, it's likely that this, I wrote something and now I'm going to tell myself I'm awful because I don't like the way it reads. You are practicing telling yourself you're awful. You're practicing the wrong thing. Practice something different. Write it, and now do something different. Like maybe look at it and say, wow, that word looks awesome. And you know what? Find a little compliment. Find a little gem to give yourself. Like I say, we're almost infinitely reprogrammable. I don't know what's going to work and what's not going to work. It may be that what you need to do is surround yourself with a writer's group who will tell you, these are the things that worked, these are the things that didn't work, but wow, I can tell you put a lot of time into this chapter, and that's what it takes. Heidi, how many words have you written? Do you know?
Probably a lot, but most of it academic writing, because I teach college.
Okay. technical writing helped me write comic strips. That probably doesn't help you at all either. Well, yes, sir.
I was going to say, too, it could be very much along the lines of what you've been saying. We tend to reward ourselves for the wrong things. We reward ourselves when we win a contest, when we do this or that. If you can get into the habit of saying, I did it, I wrote 2,000 words today. Or I rewrote this scene 10 times. You know, and you're rewarding yourself for that and saying, yes, I did it. And don't even look at how good it is.
Well, that's a good point. When I say we're almost infinitely reprogrammable, the pleasure center, the part that triggers when you eat something like really, really delicious sushi. Any sushi fans in the room? Like really, really delicious ice cream? Any ice cream fans in the room? Okay. All right, this is not helping me with my weight loss. And that's part of what I do. I'll sit down, I'll start working, I'll realize, all right, I need to reward myself for putting in the time today. I got to spend 10 hours drawing, and I don't like doing that. I mean, I like drawing, but sometimes it physically starts to hurt. And then 8 hours in, I think, you know what? If I can go for another 2 hours, I get to go to the all-you-can-eat sushi buffet. So my weight is a direct result of me overcoming my laziness. Or something. Heidi, you have asked the million-dollar question, and if I had the answer, I'd write a self-help book and be rich and change the world. So,
I was in marching band in high school, and we had a fantastic marching band. We actually were small enough that we were supposed to be in this group, but we were good enough that they moved us up to this one.
Cool.
And but one of the things my band director always told us is, I don't care if you take first, I don't care if you even place. If you can walk off that field knowing you did your absolute best, you won.
And we, I was on swim teams, and we had a slogan, winning is beating your own time. I don't need to swim faster than the other guy. I need to swim faster than I swam last time. Which is completely the opposite of the, I don't need to outrun the bear, I just need to outrun everybody else who's trying to outrun the bear. Set goals that reward you for your work. Find ways to practice the things that are most difficult for you. Look at the shortcuts you take. The next time you take a shortcut, look at it, identify it, find out why you're taking it, and if you're taking it because you actually don't know how to do the hard part, or because the hard part is so hard that it's tedious and tiresome, maybe that's what you should be doing all the time, is the tedious, tiresome, hard part, so that it becomes easy for you. Don.
A little off topic, but your slot books in the bookstore?
Yeah.
Are they kind of self-contained? Does it matter where we
If
start?
You had to pick up a book, if you want to pick up a book and read Schlock Mercenary without spending a whole lot of money on the whole set, I would pick up Resident Mad Scientist, which is book 6. So that's one of my favorite stories. They are all self-contained, but it is definitely a serial where you're rewarded for reading the whole thing. But I think 6 is a good choice. So, yes, sir.
Do you have any recommendations for finding an expert or convincing the expert to help you or anything like that?
Name the domain.
Writing.
Writing. Okay, sorry. I mean, if you said basketball, we're out of luck. Writing. This event, Life, the Universe, and Everything, which is BYU's genre fiction event, but you... genre podcast. Fiction, whatever. Yeah. There are podcasts. The Writing Excuses podcast is, I happen to know, it's pretty okay. thank you. You're too kind. No, I mean it. That's far too kind.
No.
But come to events like this. Mm-hmm. Is this your first Storymakers?
Second.
Okay. There are people here who can help you. Learn their names. One trick. I'm horrible with names. We're all wearing name tags, and so I make a point. And if you watch me in a conversation, which you're not going to have a chance to do, because I'm going to go home and take a nap immediately after this, because there's creative stuff that needs to happen. But if you watch me in a conversation at an event, you will see me look down at a name tag and then say something like, Emily, you had a question and I wanted to make sure I got back to it. And I might use Emily's name one or two more times in the conversation because I am practicing two things. Practicing teaching myself that people's names are important, and practicing Emily's name. I've now said it 3 times, I'm probably not going to forget it. Although you're going to move around and change your hair and change your clothing, and I'm doomed. And I do that at restaurants with my servers. I will name my server. Oh, you know, hey Bob, thanks for the glass of water. My server's like, why did he call me Bob? Oh, I'm wearing my name on my chest. All I'm doing is practicing using names, and I'm practicing using names, I promise I'm bringing this back around, so that I can solve this problem for myself, so that I know who people are, and when I find out that somebody has expertise in a domain in which I'm a rank amateur, I know them by name, and I'm comfortable speaking to them. So, was that a useful trick, maybe? Yeah. Krista?
Yeah, but another, just to add to that, your writing group, if you are all actively writing, if you are actively submitting, if you're actively trying to improve your technique, your knowledge, you're coming to these and you're reporting back, if you're being there for your writing group, not just for you, you are becoming experts for
yeah.
each other. And I mean, we live yeah. in a very tiny remote part of Wyoming, and there's three of us in our writing group for 5 years now. And that we're all we have, except for, you know, online.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
You have raised up your own little generation
yeah,
of experts.
We are all actively submitting and writing and trying
okay.
to get better ourselves.
Okay, we're out of time, so I want you all to join me in saying five words.
You worked hard at this.
Thank you. I don't know. Okay, done.